I'm longing for dear old Broadway, longing for dear old town. Yes, I'm longing to stroll on Broadway, watching the world go round. To be back where the boys all know me, back where the girls all bow.
This is the North Carolina Theater Story Show. I'm your host, Lynn Pryor. James Johnson is our technical director. You can listen to this and all previous episodes at nctheaterstories.com. The theater is spelled E-R. Thank you. We're coming to you from a 100-year-old house, former home of the Gilbert Theater, here in historic Haymont in Fayetteville, North Carolina. This is show number 29. Our guest today is the very talented and versatile actor Ken Griggs. Ken is a well-known and much-loved actor in our region. Most recently, he aced the part of George Bailey in the memorable Gilbert Theater production of It's a Wonderful Life. By day, Ken plays his most serious role as a radiologist with Lumberton Radiology Consultants. Ken, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've been waiting to see you on stage at the Gilbert for years and years and years. We finally did that at Christmas time. And now here we have, this is a double whammy here, getting you for our podcast. Ken, we have just been listening to our theme song. It's a wonderful, it is a wonderful life, but our theme song is Longing to Be on Old Broadway. Isn't that catchy? Cole Porter.
Love
in 1913, when he was just getting started, we just love having it, and it is in public domain, so we're not having to pay anything. But Ken, if you are longing to be on Old Broadway, what would it be?
Okay, well, truthfully, I am longing to be on Old Broadway. It's on my bucket list, actually, and I haven't yet auditioned, but I'm gonna now that I'm out of the Army and I have the ability, and so really, I just want to put my feet on the boards and say, I've been in a Broadway show. So that's the easy answer. But I think what you're looking for more is what part would I like? My favorite musical I've ever done, mm-hmm. Has been Ragtime. I think it's smart. I think it's timely. The music is as brilliant as they come. It's as close to the old Cole Porter, I think, that any modern songwriter has come. So to play Father for a revival of Ragtime, I think that would be. And that would be a dream of mine.
Well, so you have on your bucket list, you are going to be up there, and I believe you're going to make it. That's for sure, and I'll be front seat. Ken, now let's talk about your childhood.
Okay.
And tell us me about your childhood. Where were you born and your folks and your siblings or whatever?
It's very similar to my kid's childhood. I was born in Maryland as the son of an Army officer, born in the hometown where both my parents and their parents grew up in Damascus, Maryland. And my father was working at the Pentagon off and on. He made that hour-long commute from his hometown. And then I was fortunate enough to travel with him as he was sent to various posts around the world, most memorably being Germany, Korea. Those were the overseas posts I went to. And at both of them, things happened that changed who I am in just a really cool way. And probably the most significant for this environment is when I was 13, living in Seoul, Korea, and I was, like all 13-year-old boys, the bane of my mother's existence. My dad came to me and had a relatively rare father-son sit-down talk when he said, you know what, you're driving your mom crazy. You need to find something to do. And I was like, well, Dad, I play soccer, and I'm in the band. I take photos with the photo club. He goes, no, you need something to really occupy your time. He goes, look, there's a theater here. They're having auditions for some show. I don't know what it is. Why don't you go audition? He goes, you might be good at that. And I said, okay.
Oh, my gosh. So father-son talk, look where it led.
So this was in Seoul, Korea, and it was a Department of Defense community theater. actually very, very similar to the Gilbert style of theater, except with wonderful facilities. I mean, just massive budget that they had. Beautiful set shop, and I think they had a staff of like 8 full-time employees. It was wonderful. And as soon as I got there, it was Once Upon a Mattress, and I auditioned, and, you know, I was a 6-foot-tall, 13-year-old kid, weighed about 150 pounds, pimply face and all elbows, you know, and so the director said, oh, absolutely, you're going to be one of the Proteans, sort of one of the chorus members in this, and a eunuch. And I said, I don't, what's a eunuch?
And what did he say?
he said, just follow our lead. You'll figure it out eventually.
Get your dictionary.
But the funniest thing was I was sitting there at the audition and I said, wow, all of these women are gorgeous. And all these men are gay. This is like a candy shop for me. And so that's what got my foot in the door. And then over the years since then, I think I did 6 shows with them at that theater over a 2-year period. So when I got back to the States as a sophomore in high school, I had already done, you know, 6 full, you know, semi-professional shows with really talented people and a great director who I still keep in touch with on Facebook, and it's just led to, you know, this love that I have now.
Mm-hmm. So the first role you had was as a eunuch?
Correct.
Being a tenor must have been helpful there.
Yes. It has one of my favorite lines. It was he says, hurry, hurry, and they're not going fast enough, and he goes, hurry. And her response is, don't you lower your voice at me.
So what were the other shows, do you remember?
Oh, goodness gracious. I remember my first principal role was, I was the jester in Once Upon a Mattress. I was one of the cast members in Godspell. Let's see, I was Finch in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Goodness gracious.
It's taxing, I know. It's been a while.
It's been a while, yeah. It's a few years.
So you have siblings.
I do.
Yeah. And tell me about them.
I have 2 older brothers. We look nothing alike. But all 3 of us have similar voices, which is interesting. Uh-huh. Yeah, my oldest brother, he sings and plays guitar. My middle brother does not sing or play an instrument, but he should. He's just he's a super, super, almost savant smart guy. He's the smartest guy in every room he's in.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm not sure if he knows it. I think he might.
Huh. So that's it, the 3 of you.
Yeah.
And you're the youngest.
I'm the youngest.
He's the smart one, but you have the PhD.
I think he has
not a PhD.
Too much training. MD.
MD.
MD. Oh.
Similar.
My next question was going to be about the first play that you remember seeing while you were in it.
Actually, the first play, in a specific memory, I remember, and I didn't realize until I did the show what this play was, that when I did The Fantastics with Lee Yop here in Fayetteville, it was the first time I'd done it, and I played El Gallo, and I remember the death scene.
Yes.
And Lee told me, he says, Ken, a lot of people like to have red flowers in their hand, and they throw them up like blood. And I said, well, that's what I saw in my first play. I was in 2nd grade. I was in Germany. I remember it. And I remember seeing this guy dressed in black having an elaborate fake death. Uh-huh. And he didn't have red flower petals. He had a red piece of silk that he threw up, and it had like a piece of clay in it. And it like a spray of blood.
Oh,
and it was this elaborate thing. And I remember thinking that was the coolest thing ever. Uh-huh. And so that's when I realized that was the first play I saw.
So 2nd grade. So then when your father at age 13 told you to get busy, you just took to it like...
I did, yeah.
So when you saw Fantastics, it really did, it changed. You remembered it, so you thought this is a way to tell stories, perhaps.
Yeah.
And you want to be part of that. But the first time you were on stage really was in Korea.
Correct. I think I did some middle school shows or something like that, but it was, you know, just as one of the many.
Uh-huh.
It really wasn't It wasn't a real show with real rehearsal. I see.
Now, were you lucky enough in high school to have a good high school program?
I did. I had a good program. I wish I was one of those guys who could say, "Oh, my high school drama teacher changed my life." And she did not. she really did not. She was not a person I'm keeping in my memory box.
I see. Yeah.
But I had a great group of people. Great friends, and I'm still friends with a lot of those folks.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, there's about four people that I'm in touch with who can beat me regularly in Scrabble, and two of them were from my high school drama.
Very smart group of people. I know I've talked about this before in some other podcast, but I was one of the lucky ones. My high school drama teacher is the one that got me really cemented into it. Elizabeth Abraham, she got her master's in theater at Northwestern, and in my small town in Northern California, we're very lucky to have her. She had marvelous taste, and I was, all 4 years, drama one, drama two, all 4 years. I just found one of my high school report cards. I just sent it to my granddaughter, Cassidy, up in Vermont, and I said, this tells it all. It was A and drama, A in civics, A, then chemistry, D minus, trigonometry, D minus, and those were complimentary grades. Those were gifts. They just couldn't fail you because they didn't want to have you back.
Right.
I felt very lucky to have her, and I'm one that does hold my high school drama teacher in high esteem. And I used to go back and see her all for years until she died. Now, formal training. So you had those high school classes, and that.
And I didn't take drama classes in high school.
Oh, you didn't.
Matter of fact, even everything I did was as a club. I did forensics, but it was as a club.
I did
drama as a club.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't take any classes.
I see.
I should have.
I remember the first time I heard the phrase "willing suspension of disbelief" was like about my sophomore year. I said, "What does that mean?" I was going through the dictionary. Training. So what about training? We'll get to your voice later. But as far as acting, is it just so you're so good at it? It's just.
I think I had in Korea. These guys were good. Larry Chandler. He was my mentor.
Uh-huh.
And he was.
It was on the job.
It was on the job, yeah.
Yeah.
And he would take the time that so many directors that I meet now just can't. To just take you aside and very respectfully and respecting your profession. Mm-hmm. Even as a kid, he would pull me aside and say, "Hey, when you do that, you can't do that. You got to do it this way.
Yeah.
Try it. Okay, that's right. Or no, try it this way. Okay, uh-huh. Good. Okay, now let's go back and you do it with everybody else." Yeah. And it was wonderful. Whereas nowadays, Tom Quaintance and I, we always joke about, when I'm doing a show and I want to get better. I always want to get better. I tell every director I ever work with, I say, "Please do make me better. Give me notes. Tell me what I'm doing wrong."
Uh-huh.
And I went up to Tom one time during, I forget what it was, something he was directing me in, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm sorry. You're my lump." I was like, "A lump? What the hell's that?" And he goes, "The least of my problems."
Yeah.
"I don't have time." He says, "You're okay. You're not perfect. You're okay."
Uh-huh.
And he said, "I've got so many things that are not okay that
lump,
I've got to fix."
L-O-M-P, James.
L-O-M-P.
Add that to our our dictionary of slang.
So my goal is to not be the lump. My goal is to be really good.
Now, formal training, informal training, speaking of wanting to always be better, isn't life the best teacher after all?
Absolutely.
A day doesn't go by when I'm not on stage anymore, but things that occur to me that I know that I could translate into something on stage if I could, or as a director, you can use it for others. But I remember there was an actor sitting on the steps at the Gilbert, some years ago. I forget if Robin had arrived yet. I was there for some reason. I passed by him, and he said, Lynn, I want to talk with you." And he said, "I want to kind of pick your brain and some ideas." I said, "Fine." Well, right there, sitting next to him was a homeless person. You know, just on and out like this, you know, smoking, putting cigarettes in that sandbox. And I just couldn't take my eyes off that person. And this kid that had was asking me that, seemingly, you know, just absolutely was unaware that that person was even there. So we walk upstairs and go into the lobby and I start talking. And I'll say, well, let's call him Bill. I said, Bill, you have to be a student of life if you want to really be effective on stage. Quite frankly, did you see that person, a homeless person sitting there? No. Well, you better start getting your antenna polished, because these are the things that not only can help you building apart, but also make you more of a human being and more empathetic. And, because what all we are, after all, are storytellers. And stories are offered to us all day long, all the time. I'm never bored. I bet you're not. this life is too interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the informal training that we all get, this is why I have been very much involved in politics and social issues all my life. And I like to think that gives me, helps me mm-hmm. in the world of theater. How about you?
I feel like my interactions with patients during
course,
my day job helps me immensely with what I can put on stage. And now I'm finding out the opposite is even more true. My interactions on stage help me deal with patients, which is interesting. Yeah, yeah. As a radiologist, I don't have the same amount of contact that, say, a general practitioner would.
Yeah.
But I have to, I talk to about half a dozen patients a day for various procedures or mean things I'm about to do to them. Uh-huh. I find that I use way more of my theater craft with them than I ever thought that I would.
Uh-huh.
And not in a deceptive way, in a helpful way. It's like I need to observe them and determine what type of person are they. Are they are they someone who wants me to give them every little tiny detail of what I'm going to do and every possible complication, or are they someone who says, "Doc, you do what needs to be done."
Yeah, yeah.
And then I have to deal with them appropriately.
Yeah. Yes.
So it is a slight bit of a chameleon job to feel out who you're dealing with mm-hmm. and what do they need from you.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same thing on stage when you're working with another actor.
Yes.
You know, how do you work together to
listening in everyday life and on stage. And that's isn't one of the secrets is being listening. And when you're repeating a show over and over, but listening with fresh ears as often as one can.
Yeah.
When someone asked me in the early days of the podcast, I let people ask me questions, turning the tables. And one of them says, what is your biggest accomplishment? And I said, it's becoming in what I conceive to be truly helpful in every way. And all of my life. People say, well, I want to be helpful. Well, frequently helpful is there's hidden agendas, there's this or that.
Right.
And so when we ask for divine guidance or someone to be truly helpful, that's the key word, truly helpful. And I'd like to conduct my days, and sometimes I'll just catch myself. I have insomnia at night, in the middle of the night, 3 a.m, I'll kind of analyze my day and how did I do and what about tomorrow. Something will have come up and I'll ask myself, you know, were you truly helpful? Or are you planning something to be helpful? But, in a way, are you really analyzing this carefully enough? Are you seeking some revenge or being one up on somebody or being whatever? So, yeah. So this is the thrilling part about our business. Your career as a radiologist, my career was as a children's librarian. And it was so in sync with, well, storytelling. That's right. My whole life's been about storytelling. And so, it's a wonderful life. I mean, you don't have to be in a play with that title or see the movie to come to that conclusion that, it's just, So, let's talk about your voice. Now, okay, you're a baritone. And they're going to tell me you're tenor.
I'm a baritenor, is what I say, yeah.
I see.
That means I have tenor quality to my voice, but I can't hit high Cs. That's sort of what that means.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then I'm not really comfortable down in the basement either.
Uh-huh,
so yeah. I'm sort of right there in between.
So did you have a soprano at age 12?
Boy, I don't remember. I don't think it was soprano.
It wasn't, but I mean, you did have a big voice change?
Yes, oh yeah, yeah.
But I mean, but you were way up there. I mean,
I don't recall being wicked high. No, I don't think I was. I think I was a normal child voice
all the way through. And then when the change came, it wasn't so dramatic. I remember that when at my grade school, when we were, I guess, in sixth or seventh grade, Harold Lutz had the most glorious soprano voice before it changed, and it changed overnight. And here I am talking about all these years, you know, 70 years later, talking about it. It was, you know, that gorgeous, gorgeous, you know, Vienna Boy Square kind of
right.
voice. And then to go suddenly just in down to bass or something. But that didn't happen to you.
No.
So your voice, when did you realize, your teachers, people around you, realize that you had a special voice?
It really wasn't until high school that I started, and that's when I started singing a lot, you know, singing in church choirs, and that's really where I got most of my love for music and singing, was in church choir.
Uh-huh.
And then when I went to college at West Point, hardly an arts institution, but some wonderful choir programs, the chapel choir was beautiful.
And you were they auditioned you and you got in.
Yeah.
Of course.
Actually, they auditioned, strangely enough, it was very fascist, they auditioned the entire class. It was, you would get in a line.
In order to be.
Go up in front of the choir master and you would sing a couple bars of God Bless America or the National Anthem or something that they knew everybody knew. And then they would just write your name down.
Uh-huh. One to ten, when you were a ten.
And then you got a call to come join the choir if you wished.
Uh-huh. And you did.
I did, yeah.
You did.
And it was wonderful to play with that, you know, again, really professional organization. And that organ they have up there is the largest organ in the world. It's
really?
I forget the exact number. It's like 32,000 pipes that it has, all contained. It's got two 64-foot stops of you know, the 64-foot pipe. They can't have them all on or the windows break.
Right.
it's an amazing...
Occasional eardrum.
Yeah, so I would love singing with them. And then as soon as I was allowed to, you have to be a sophomore to join the Glee Club. I joined the Glee Club. And traveled the world singing with just a great group of men's voices.
Oh, so you did that after graduation?
No. It was as a sophomore.
A sophomore. During the off-time summer or something?
No, it was a
class?
It wasn't a class, but it was a club that took up as much time as many of the athletic teams.
Oh, I see.
It was pretty serious.
Wonderful.
And some wonderful musical talent.
Is that still there?
Oh, yeah.
The West Point Glee Club.
The Cadet Glee Club is what it's called.
I see.
Yeah.
And you went all over the world.
All over the world. There's, matter of fact, there was a PBS special that I didn't find out until years later of me singing Go Tell It on the Mountain in St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And it was wonderfully produced. I mean, I remember standing there. I remember seeing the cameras and thinking, oh, this is just some local Irish television type of thing. And then I saw West Point Glee Club sing St. Patrick's at this big Christmas special, and I was like, wow, that's me. Singing Go Tell It on the Mountain. It was pretty cool.
My God.
I was like, wow, I didn't suck either. It was good.
So you were getting solos early on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my whole life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mostly because I think I had a big enough voice, even as a teenager.
I see.
And again, that's, you know, Larry Chandler told me, he said, and it was actually bad advice, but it turned out to help me. His advice was, make your voice loud enough so that you can hear your voice bouncing off the back wall of the theater, and you should be able to hear your own voice among the group of people singing. So in those first few shows, I would sing like this with this really piercing, annoying sound.
That's how
I heard it.
Heard his advice.
Yeah, that was his advice, yeah. It was horrible. I'd listen to these tapes and I'd hear this sticky outy tenor. And it wasn't until I got to work with the amazing John Solanchian, I'm 30 years old, with the San Antonio Master Singers Choir. And they are a group of, it's like 120 strong. They sing exclusively with the San Antonio Symphony. And at the time, I was the only person in that choir who did not have a music degree. I mean, it was a really talented group of people. But I remember him saying one time, he was like, okay, there's a sticky addy tenor back over there somewhere. Whoever it is, make it stop. I don't know if he was talking about me, but at least it made me cognizant of it. That was wonderful. I think that's that experience with the San Antonio Master Singers. That's what took me from being just a decent choral singer to someone who can sight read music, someone who can, understand what a musical piece requires of a singer. Both as a soloist and as a choir member.
So again, on the job. So you were producing, pursuing all the things that the Armory was requiring, and later in the medical world, but then so you had two. I'm going to talk about you in two parallel careers, if I may, tonight.
Sure.
I think it makes it's only right, and to do that. Now let's imagine that we're here in the studio, aka my dining room. That we have a frieze going around the top of the, like this molding, and of your career, of your experience, of your in theater, and what would, okay, we've already talked about some things, but here are the first pictures here, and then we're going to go around and around and around, Ken, and so you had your second grade, you have seen
The Fantastics.
Fantastics. Yeah. That would be one picture of you sitting there, this being blown away by this play, and this person dying and all. And then we have you in high school, and then we have you, Aubrey, at West Point with the singing. So there's been so a lot of singing, but when did the acting come in? Well
here's an interesting side, is that when I was a junior in high school, I had pretty much decided that I was going to go into musical theater as a profession, and had started researching as best as one could at the time, pre-internet days and whatnot.
Sure.
I had determined that I applied to five schools, or at least I sent letters for applications to five schools. And it was, I specifically remember Carnegie Mellon, Juilliard, Northwestern, I forget the other two, but they were NYU might have been one of them as well. And this was all for musical theater. And so I got all of these applications, and I filled them all out. And all of them required, I don't know if they still do, I don't think they do, but you had to send a check in with each one. And my parents were very firm that I had to write those checks. Those checks had to come out of my account.
Good for them.
They were wonderful. and they never told me, you know, hey, did you get your applications in? And that. They just, it was all up to me. And so I had these five applications, and it was like $100, $150, somewhere in that, of checks that I had to write. And it was taxing my financial resources at the time. As I was taking this stack of applications out to my mailbox, I opened up the mailbox to stick them in. This is at my parents' house. And there was...
And how old were you?
At home, in Maryland, in Damascus.
How old were you?
I was 17. Yeah, right. And I opened up the mailbox, and the mail had already come. But instead of the usual stack of junk mail and whatnot, there was one piece of mail that had come that day. And it was one of those little tear-off, snap things. And it had my name on it. And it was from West Point. And so I tore it off and snapped it open, and it said, "Congratulations, you've been accepted to West Point." I got an early admission because my brother was there. My dad was a veteran, and I was an Eagle Scout. You know, all that crap that makes you wonderful in their eyes. And so I was looking at that acceptance, thinking, oh, that's good. And I was looking at I was like, I've got over $100 worth of checks written here that I can just keep. So it was in that moment that I decided, I'm going to go into the Army. I'm not going to go do musical theater.
Wow.
I threw all of those applications in the trash.
My gosh, this is straight out of it.
It's hilarious.
Out of Frank Capra.
And of all of the stories I may tell that I may exaggerate, that's not one of them.
One?
That's exactly how it happened. I mean, I remember I had the thing in one hand and this stack of envelopes in the other. I was like, yeah, I'm not doing it.
Boy, so, if that had been delayed a week or something, we would have... Your bucket list would have been fulfilled ages ago, and we would have been going up there to see you on Broadway. I hadn't thought about this for years. My brother was accepted at West Point and refused, and I don't think he ever regretted it, and I think the country was better off for it. So we're continuing our freeze, and okay, now there's this fateful day at the mailbox, and then you begin your years there at West Point, and in the Glee Club, as you say.
And I did, actually, some interesting stuff happened there. I got involved with the Theater Arts Guild, and we did, I remember I was Oberon in Midsummer. I was Will Parker in Oklahoma, and it was actually a pretty good show. I thought I was a shoe-in for Curly. I was like, oh, this is great. I get to be Curly in Oklahoma. And I'll be darned if one of the new coming plebes in the class behind me hadn't just finished an 8-month stint as a non-equity tour Curly for Oklahoma.
This kid had this one of those
beautiful
things.
Baritone voice, and it was just perfect for the role. And I was like, oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll be his Will Parker any day. And it was wonderful. It was a great show. We had, you know, just some strong people. And then we wrote our own shows. Each class would have two performances that they had to give, one 500 nights before they graduate and one 100 nights before they graduate. And
two in the whole 4 years?
The class performed and wrote, correct.
Right.
And so myself and one of my roommates and dear friends, who is just a brilliant man and a brilliant writer, we decided to write, instead of a collection of sketches as they normally do, poking fun at the institution, we decided to write a musical. And so we wrote this musical that was pretty bad for 500th night. And then for 100th night, we decided to continue the story of that musical using the same characters and whatnot. And we did. And that was actually quite good. We had the ghosts of West Point, basically all of the statues. We had actors dress up as the statues of Patton and MacArthur and all that. And so we had them become characters, sort of like Toy Story, you know, when the lights go out, these guys come to life. And it was great. It was a good show. A lot of people were like, that was some of the best we've ever had. And these are folks who've been there forever. So it was nice. But still, it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same caliber of theater, the same experience that I've had since then. So after I graduated and went on to med school and then to residency, and I took about a 13-year gap that I took from doing theater like this, like we do here. And I did a lot of music, a lot of choirs, a lot of singing. I had a little acoustic guitar trio. We went all over the country playing, and that was fun. But no theater. And it wasn't until I got to Fayetteville.
What year was that?
I got here in 99. And then the first year after your residency, you're studying for your boards, your big medical board exams. And so I passed those. And the day that I got my "you passed your board exam" thing, I was like, oh, thank God. What an albatross off my neck. I'm now board certified.
Yes.
I'm done with you know, feeling like I'm not being a good student if I'm not constantly studying radiology. And my wife said, well, why don't you go do a show? And I'm like, well, okay. And we opened up the newspaper, and it said, Cape Fear Regional Theater having auditions for South Pacific.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, my gosh, I am perfect for Lieutenant Cable. I have the right voice. I have the right look. I'm the right age. This is perfect. And so I walked in and...
and someone from New York got it.
And I did very well. But to make a long story short, yeah, someone from New York got it. And Bo was very honest with me, Bo Thorpe, at the time. She said, I love your look. I love your voice. She says, but I don't know you. I don't know that I can trust you with this part. You have no resume. You have no experience. I don't know if you're going to get sick and lose your voice. I don't know if you're a crappy actor. And I said, that's fair enough. You know, I can accept that. So thank you for your time. And that she wanted me to be one of the ensemble guys, sure. And I didn't want to take that time away from my kids. And I said, okay, well, I guess I just won't do theater.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so I basically just shelved it. And And then I got deployed to Bosnia soon thereafter. And this actually, now it's 2001. I got deployed to Bosnia on September 11th, 2001. Yeah, it was weird. We didn't find out about it until we landed in Bosnia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was crazy. It was a short deployment. It was like 5 months. And as the day before I came back, I get a phone call from my wife. And she says, are you at all interested in doing a little theater when you get back? Because the theater's in trouble. They need your help. They were doing The Music Man. My daughter was Amaryllis. So my wife was, you know, constantly there, and she knew what was going on. And one of the actors got a family emergency, had to go away. And they said, could you possibly fill in for this role for just like a week? I'm like, sure, fine. Yeah, because I have some leave, automatic leave when I get back from deployment. I'm not burning anything. Fine, I'll do this. So my family met me at the Fayetteville Airport. It wasn't the big homecomings that you have now from deployed soldiers. I met my family at the airport, gave them hugs. We got in the car. We drove to the theater. I watched dress rehearsal. The next night I was on.
Wow.
No, granted, it was as one of the ensemble members, but I played the conductor in the train. Uh-huh. I was the sheriff of the town. And Dirk Lombard, God bless him, Dirk Lombard is the reason that I'm still doing this. Because when I met him during that, I fell in love with him and his love for theater. Uh-huh. This is a Broadway professional who's come down to do this show with us, and everything about him was just the best. Uh-huh. On stage, off stage, just, he was the bee's knees. I did this show and I filled in. It was horrible. I didn't know where I was going. I just followed everybody else. Uh-huh. And fortunately, I knew all the songs, so I just picked the part and sang it. And once I finished that show, I was hooked. And Bo started calling me and saying, okay, we've got auditions coming up. I want you to come audition.
And so you've at least a dozen shows there, or more than that.
Oh, good Lord. I think I've done about 30 or 40 there.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I've seen you in most of them.
Yeah, I've done. I do about two shows a year at CFRT, and I've been doing it since 2001 or 2002.
It's close to 30 or so.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yes.
You know, some seasons I did like four, and some seasons I only do one.
Yes.
But I think I've done something there at least every year.
So our freeze is continuing with this big, big old covered wall covered with CFRT stuff, yeah. And. But then you've in recent years you've branched out. You've been at Temple.
Well, I've been there for a long time.
A long time.
Yeah, since 2007, I did the Fantastics there, and just loved it. And that was right before Peggy got there. So I did the Fantastics. I loved the space of the Temple Theater, and yeah. I didn't really get to know the staff there during the Fantastics because it was such a short stand-up, because everybody had done their roles before.
Uh-huh.
We ran the show off book on our third day of rehearsal. We did a read-through on day one. We blocked it on day two. We ran the show on day three, off book. It's like, okay, now we got 2 weeks. What are we going to do?
My God.
So it was, in terms of smoothness and slickness and professionalism, that's probably the best I've ever, best I've ever been around.
Well, she's marvelous, Peggy Taphorn. I was there yesterday. My barbershop group is going to—they're having a fundraiser, the Vaudeville Night.
Oh yeah.
And my barbershop group is going to be part of one of the vaudeville acts. And I was there yesterday, going backstage for the first time. We go to all their shows. Doubt is opening Thursday, and we love their work and Peggy and that backstage is a trip. Literally a trip. I mean, the band that was showing us around couldn't find the lights, and I was picturing myself headlong on some on my face.
There's something about that stage, though, that of all the stages I've been on, that space is my favorite.
I
can't really explain why. I don't know.
The ghost, of all those Bonvillians.
It could be. I think it is the plaster. Yeah. You got that plaster curved front wall,
yeah, right, yes.
And then all the walls are nice high in plaster. And
yeah.
And like I said, Larry Chandler taught me to hear my voice.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons I'm a little uncomfortable on the CFRT stage is because I have a hard time hearing my voice.
I see.
And I will auto-adjust. It's subconscious. When you know people say, oh, take it easy with your voices. Mark tonight so you don't rip out your throat. I'm incapable of doing that. I will continue to hit my volume up until I hear that echo of my own voice.
I see.
And at the temple, it's wonderful. You can talk like this, and
yes.
You can just hear it ringing off the walls.
Those tin ceiling, I guess that part of it helps.
Yeah.
No, I love going there and sit there and so we have the CFRT, we have the temple, we have the Gilbert. So our timeline up to the present, right there, and there is it's a wonderful life. But now, what's next on this frieze, on this around the room?
So next thing I am doing now, my second military consultant role. I'm going to help out CFRT with their downrange.
Their original piece
that they're doing with Mike Wiley. I haven't yet met with him about it, but I've talked to Tom a couple times, and I'm very excited about that. So I'm going to basically help his actors learn how to look military and how to say things in a military way, like army.
Is Mike Wiley the same gentleman behind the Parchment Hour?
Correct.
Who wrote that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, he is brilliant, and I saw the first read through that they did of this, and it's just wonderful. It's a great piece. You know, it talks about, it's mostly about those left behind, the families of soldiers who deploy, and what they go through. And it's wonderful. So he took interviews, hours and hours, countless hours of interviews, and then wrote this play based on that. So yes, there's a lot of real story in here, but it's not any verbatim. You know, it's not, oh, I'm telling Mrs. Jones's story,
it's
and now
it's a compilation.
It's just a compilation, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's well done, and it's theater. You know, it's got a point. So hopefully I'll be able to help them sort out the military stuff.
Yes. Oh, good.
And you know, because you hear a lot of things in the movies and in a book where they have a soldier or a Marine or an airman say something, they're like, oh yeah, they would never say that. The one that you see in every show is like if a soldier is upset and his superior tells him to do something, he goes,
this is a family show. I was going to warn you.
they always say that. They go, yes, sir. Uh-huh. I'm like, yeah, that would never happen.
I've never
30 years in the military. I've never said that to anyone. I never had anyone say it to me.
Yes.
You can tell if someone's upset.
Yes.
You know, they
with the veneer of.
But they, you don't do that.
Yes.
It's just not done.
It's not done.
Or you hear people say, you'll have an army guy in the movies, and they'll go, hoorah! I'm like, no, that's a Marine Corps thing. Army guys go, hooah!
Hooah.
It's totally different.
Yes, right. When we did our Vietnam, when the mayor, Schiavone, was doing that welcome home to the Vietnam vets, and the Gilbert did something, and we used that book, what they carried with them. Do you know that one?
Yes, I haven't read it, but I remember, I've heard people talking about it.
Yes. So that's the working on that. And then
my next play is, Arsenic and Old Lace at CFRT. Followed by, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be involved with The Ring of Fire at CFRT. That's about as far forward as I go. But my problem is with my new job in Lumberton, I can't go do shows in Sanford. I can't go do shows in Raleigh.
Uh-huh.
And that's really got me bummed out.
Yeah, I bet.
Because I've done several shows up in Raleigh in the past several years, and I've really enjoyed it.
Yes.
What with Theater Raleigh, which used to be Hot Summer Nights. And I've done a couple things with NCT, And, you know, that's, it's not a full equity theater, but it's an equity theater. And so if I was ever going to get my card, that's the place around here where I'd have to go to do it.
I see. Well, yes. Well, your family, you speak of your wife urging you to go. I'm sure she's never regretted it. he says with a wink. But your wonderful wife, Lindsay, we're all crazy about her, and your wonderful children. And one of them is, even though you did not mail that letter to Carnegie Mellon.
She did.
She did. And so you're blessed. You're disappointed that you, what you just said, but as far as lives go, I suspect you have very few disappointments.
That is true.
Let's talk about some nitty gritty of theater stuff. Ken, how important is an audience to you? You know, we rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, and maybe a few people are watching it, and then suddenly you have opening night and so on. How does that things change for you?
And I think I've had this conversation with you before. For me, the performance, the audience, is the gravy. It's the cherry on top. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that makes that gives flavor to the sustenance. Mm-hmm. So for me, the meat is the process of getting there. It's the auditions. It's the read through. It's the rehearsals. It's the arguments. The professional confrontations that you have about, you know, artistic differences and the way you solve that. And it's getting the costumes right and the set and the lightings and finding your light and getting that doggone microphone to work and blah, 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 all that stuff. To me, that's the meat. That's why I do it. That's what gives me the fuel to keep going. The audience response
is the cherry.
Is that cherry. It's the gravy. It's what makes it so much better. And it's what makes it memorable.
Yeah.
So I can have a wonderful process, a wonderful piece of meat. But what makes it stick out in my mind is oh yeah, and we sold out every night. Oh yeah, we had that standing ovation that went on forever. Oh yeah, there was that one time where this happened, and we could not go on for a full 30 seconds because the audience would not stop laughing.
Uh-huh.
You know,
that's
the gravy. That's what makes it wonderful.
And so if you have in a small theater, very intimate space like the Gilbert, and you see the first few rows, that's for sure, invariably. The first time when we were still downstairs on the old theater, I was in these last 22 years, I've been in two plays, and this first one I was in, it was an original script, and I'd done it in Berkeley, California, and with the Mayor stage, and when the lights went, we rehearsed, and then when the lights went off, here I built this damn thing. And, you know, I knew that I had shown people their seats in the front row and told them not to put their feet on the stage. And so finally I'm on stage and I come out, the lights go up, and there were people like they were, you know, literally on stage. You know, you just didn't see the shadowy thing. You saw, you know, just sitting there like this. And it took here, and I'm sure all those actors and actresses that had gone before me had said, oh, he's getting a touch of his own now.
Right.
And creating this monster. And I went, I don't know, I hope I found my first line without embarrassing myself.
Right.
But speaking of standing ovations, closing night of It's a Wonderful Life, I finally got smart and changed my, I saw it six times. Could have easily seen it 12. Something, I don't know what it says about me, but it's, when I see a play or a movie or something, it's like I'm seeing, well, particularly plays, I feel like I'm seeing it for the first time. I just, you know, I'm noticing new things, and I'm just as excited the 12th time as I am the first. And, but I changed my position. I was more over the audience right. And I said, why did you wait to find this spot over here? It's much better with the blocking and all. Anyway, I finally did. But that closing night, when you're out there doing that, you're down center in this large cast for our stage, is right there. And I caught your eye, and it was just, we were all standing and cheering and applauding, and it was just marvelous.
It was a wonderful experience. It really was. Everything about it. And can't wait to do it again.
Great. Wonderful. So, you know, it's a circle, isn't it? Audience, actors, play, you know, the whole, it's a circle. You know, you become kind of, you tend to talk in trite phrases, like right now. But it's true that, you know, people, People, we so many of us who were seeing the play when Robin chose It's a Wonderful Life, you know, I got out the movie again, and you had said that you were not going to see it very smartly. But I saw the movie again, and I have the colorized version of it, and we now agree it's better than the black and white. I didn't think I'd ever say that about a colorized. But the, I enjoyed it once again so much. But then to see it on stage, you know, that word live.
Yep.
It's when people say, well, you know, they see movies all the time. And we all love, I love movies. I'm with the Cameo all the time. And they've been so enriched my life so much over the years. But then you see a well put up play, and there's a huge difference.
Huge. Huge difference. It's a different art form.
It's just, you know, it's apples and oranges. I realize that, but, you know, but people, you know, but we've so caught up in these two dimensional screens, you know, screens. I want to scream about the screens. You don't catch me at most of these screens these days. Of course, I'm too slow to understand it, as James will tell you. But to see something live, it is just, it does something to your interior, it does something to your heart, it does something to your mind, everything.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Every chance I get, I try to put it in all of my bios, you know, to thank the audience for supporting live theater and to keep doing it.
Well, yes, it's our gift to them, but then their gift back is being there and being with you, but. Sometimes, you know, Elizabeth Abraham, my drama teacher in high school, if she said it, stay in character once, you know, she said it 5,000 times.
Right.
And that was so like that. But there have been times, mainly in Berkeley, when I, as an adult, doing plays, things would be, I would look out at a face, just catch a face, and have to really bring myself back, to the character and where I am. I suppose, do you have that happen on occasion?
Very rarely. I have found that most of the time when I'm on stage, if I'm being totally honest, I'm me. I'm an actor. I know that I'm up there acting, and very rarely do I get so deeply involved in it that I lose track of it.
Uh-huh.
But it does happen.
Well, it does happen.
It's magic.
Well, because it could be a look on a face. You know, you really are being in the moment. You're this, you're that, being like to think, you know, as professional as can be. But you look out at a certain face and see it's such a deep reaction to what's been going on that, at least for speaking for myself, it takes me out for that second.
Right.
I think, oh my God. You know, this person is absolutely, you know, like, I mean, I think back to, in the Blood, Susan Laurie Parks, that woman, that homeless woman who
right.
lived under this bridge with her children. And I wasn't in it, but I was positioned myself so I can see faces. And I wasn't even on stage, and I was just like this and seeing what was happening to the audience.
Right.
So what types of shows appeal to you the most? Of course, musicals.
I love musicals. I really do.
Don't we all?
Yeah. I always say it embarrassingly, embarrassed, because, yeah, it is, they are in many ways sort of cheap. You know,
but they bring such joy to our lives.
And I love them. Mm-hmm. See, it, in my mind, I think of it the classic. If you ask old theater people, why do actors sing? Why does that character sing? And it's because what they're feeling is so powerful that they can't just say it in words. They have to sing it.
Yeah.
And I try to think that as opposed to, okay, here comes this next number, here I go, and a 1, 2, 3, and start into it. It's that I want to say something, but no, it's just so powerful. I can't just say it. I have to sing it.
Yeah.
And I try to go for that.
I guess it's from Oklahoma on, right? Isn't that right. Historians about American musicals, Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy, you know, that suddenly you look at those old black and white movies and suddenly they're doing something and then suddenly, boom, Nelson is singing. Right. And, it doesn't have the same impact in modern musicals.
Right. So many more of the modern musicals are of the opera style, where it's not like, darling, I love you, now I'm going to sing a song about love. No, it's darling, I love you, and now I'm going to sing a song about how we met and why I love you. And you have to listen.
And how it furthers the plot.
And how it furthers the plot. Exactly.
Yeah, right, yeah. Now, Ken, as we all get older, do you see how do you view yourself in 10 years from now? As you grow older, how that might affect your career?
I feel lucky to get to do any role that I do get to do, as a white male, uh-huh. I'm very fortunate that there are tons of roles out there from the time I'm 20 years old to the time I'm 60.
Yeah.
I just change the shows that I'm looking to do. Uh-huh. I'm no longer looking at West Side Story. I'm no longer looking at Oklahoma, but I might have a couple Music Men left in me still.
Oh, I know you would. A bit of Grecian formula, and you'd be right there. Now, I want to bring you down to back to the nitty-gritty of the preparation for opening night. How do you personally work with your fellow actors?
In what way?
Well, I mean, how do you hold your fellow actors? Sometimes you're working with somebody new, so other times it's people you worked with before.
Right.
I imagine that you would be somebody who would be a mentor or be very generous and helpful to somebody new.
If they ask. And
you don't dare, otherwise.
And with the director's permission. Uh-huh. Even if they ask, I ask them to ask the director.
Uh-huh.
But I try to give everyone the same respect that I would want.
Yeah.
And although there are times when I see an actor do something, I'm like, oh yeah, that's clearly not the right thing to do.
But it's not.
I am incapable.
Yes.
And
then you're so right. The wrath of the director will fall on you.
Yeah.
But that's what I wanted anyway.
But I always make the assumption going in that everyone is every bit as good or if not better than me, and that even if they make a choice that I disagree with, uh-huh. instead of saying that's a stupid choice, I really make an effort to go, okay, why do I think that's a stupid choice? Uh-huh. What is my prejudicial look into uh-huh. this that's making me think that they're wrong and that I'm right. And
that helps you grow.
It does.
As well as, but your fellow actors will see that, you know, eyes are the windows of the soul. It's a cliche, but it's the truth. And so fellow actors, I know working with you, and I've heard them say this, that what a dear person, someone I can trust, someone that I love working with, and that just a joy to be with.
Well, I couldn't ask for a better compliment. Thank you.
Do you have any insecurities?
Tons.
Are you willing to share
absolutely.
Two of them?
Oh, I can't dance to save my life. And every time I do have to dance, it's very taxing, and it's my insecurity that makes it even worse.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Because if I would just relax and let it go and do these dance steps poorly but with confidence, I would look fine. Uh-huh. Yeah, no one would notice. Yeah. But it's the fact that I'm Mr. Stiffy up there and I'm looking at my feet, it's just horrible. I'm a horrible, horrible dancer. And I have to do it all the time. In every show, I have to do some type of dancing. And I have incredibly bowed knees. I am bow-legged like you would not believe.
So even when you were in naked on the stage in
Full Monty,
I did not say someone, a big dog could walk between those legs.
Well, because I had a big dog fill in the gap, right? No, we know better. You saw me naked on stage. No, it's mostly when my feet are together. I have just.
This is a family show.
It is a family show. I did not say anything inappropriate. All right. I have like a 4-inch gap between my knees when my feet are together.
Oh,
and it's
well that. It definitely qualifies you as bowling.
I'm bowling.
All right, I'm here to say that. What was your most challenging role?
My most challenging
role? Of all, on that frieze up there on the top of this studio?
I'm going to have to say that it was Dan in Next to Normal.
Oh.
I did that up at Theater in the Park
about
3 years ago. That's the one about the woman who has bipolar disorder, and I played her husband. And not only was the emotional roller coaster so difficult, vocally, I was in the stratosphere the entire show.
Oh boy!
And it's a rock and roll score, so it's a rock and roll musical score. It's not real rock and roll, but. It's up tempo and it's raw and it's raspy and it's in the stratosphere.
Oh my God. How did you protect your voice?
I failed. I lost it.
You lost it.
Yeah.
Before the end of the run.
Well, I made it through.
But did you damage it? Did you need any
probably.
Help? Did you help? Need help? Or you? Seems to be all right now.
Oh yeah, no. I damaged it in that. Yeah, it's you know like when you go to a ball game and scream your head off.
Yeah,
that's how I was at the end of the run.
My goodness.
Just a lot of water and a lot of rest. But when you're doing a show in Raleigh and you know doing an 8-hour day job, that's hard. It's hard to get enough water and rest.
Yeah.
I spent the whole time on the road, you know, sipping emergencies and I have a little cocktail that I make that. Basically a ginger tea with honey.
So that the things that, yeah, so many do. Yeah. Well, there you are. Well, you're amazing. Now, here's the little odds and ends here. Are you punctual? And if so, how important is it in the theater?
I am relatively punctual. There are times that I'm late, and if I'm going to be late, I will call. And I'm very good about that. So in terms of that, yes, I am very punctual. And it is important in the theater in that you can't work if you don't have the people you need. And so you're wasting everybody's time. And so you at least, if you're going to be late, you got to make the call.
Yes.
And, you know, there's times when it's unavoidable. And I am very respectful of my stage manager, my director, and I tell them from day one, before I sign any contract, I'm like, okay, here's the deal. I have a day job where... It's literally life and death sometimes.
Yes.
And if I'm required to stay late to deal with a patient, I'm going to stay late to deal with a patient.
Yes.
And I will make every effort to be there on time, and I usually am.
Yeah.
But almost every production, at least one or two times, I'll have an issue that I'll have to call and say, okay, I'm either not going to be there tonight or I'm going to be late.
So all of you actors out there, there it is. That's from the big man himself. Now, if I could read my writing, I won't use this page. That's card. I can't tell you how many lines.
It says family man.
Oh, that's it.
How have you handled it?
Oh, that's right. Family man. How have you handled me? Thank you. Thank you. He's even conducting the interview. You've handled it very well, I would suspect. But I've been around your family, and they're just glow.
They are wonderful. I have a wonderful family, and they, particularly my wife, understand how important theater is to me.
Yes.
For my well-being, it's my therapy, I've often used the left brain right brain comparison that my day job is my left brain and or which one is it? Yeah, my day job is my left brain, the analytical. Problem-solving type, and then the theater is my right brain, the artistic, creative, visual, spatial part. And when they're balanced, I feel great.
Yes.
I am so happy.
Yes.
And when they're not balanced, if I miss one of them, if I'm in a show and I'm not working, I'm miserable. And vice versa is true as well. And my wife knows that.
Yes.
And she is so wonderfully supportive. And
well, we all admire her. So I mean, we're aware of this. I she supports you in all of those psychological ways and practical ways. But when then she does the odd thing at theater, she's done Spotlight for the Gilbert and volunteers here and there.
Well, she's directing a show right now at Vance Story Elementary.
Oh, good for her.
She's been doing that for about 10, 12 years.
Say, would you call these the best years of your life? Or
absolutely. Provided I have better ones coming down the road.
Well, I'm sure there are. but I think... So no regrets, and I mean, great years. That's the way I look at my life. Great years. But there's nothing like today.
Correct.
All right, we're moving right along, and James is.
We're at an hour.
No, we're not. We haven't been talking an hour.
Well, here's some quickies. Most scary moment on stage.
Oh, I remember that. It was during Spamalot. We were doing a lift to bring the Lady of the Lake out, and the lift failed. And we heard a ka-chunk, and the Lady of the Lake dropped about a foot. And then we heard a scream.
Oh, that's cool.
And somebody saying, "She's not moving."
She fell.
No, this was not the Lady of the Lake. She was fine. She crawled out and was shaking like a leaf. But the stage manager who was underneath,
oh boy,
this 800-pound lift failed and fell. Oh. Actually, it didn't fail. What happened was the cable was being released, but the piece of wood that was holding it up was still there.
Yeah.
And so she was trying to pull that piece of wood out while the cable was still becoming loose. She finally did pull it out, and so then the lift fell that whole foot.
I see.
And hit her on the head.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Knocked her out. And so then I went into doctor mode real quick.
and was that Tiffany?
It'd be inappropriate to say the name.
Thank you.
So I ran downstairs and checked out our stage manager, and she was fine. She was knocked out, though, and she came to while I was there. Unfortunately, she was not injured, no long-term consequences.
But did you do that, like... Did you, like, drop character and just run off stage?
I had Excalibur with me. I had my crown on my head. And as I was running down the steps, I realized this isn't going to work. So I threw the crown off, dropped Excalibur off, and went downstairs and checked her out.
Well, there's where your two left and right brain, they meshed. Thank heaven. Most funny moment, most humorous moment on stage.
Oh, well, that's an easy one. Okay, so this was during Spamalot, and this is a breaking character moment, and I've had arguments with Tom Quaintz about this. He said he brought the point up that it's never okay to break character on stage. It's never okay to break that fourth wall like that. And I brought this time up in Spamalot.
God, he hate me.
where we were doing the Holy Hand Grenade. The Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch, and Jeremy Fiebig, he was out there, and he was the monk, and he was like, and the people feasted, and the great parties were held, and they ate the orange blossoms, and the lambs, and the goats, and the pomegranate seeds, and then King Arthur says, Brother Maynon, skip a bit. And then he skips. That's a funny bit. And then he goes, at the first thou must pull out the pin of the Holy Hand Grenade. And he goes on to that whole bit. Well, those guys, the other knights, had been having a habit of trying to make me laugh on stage. And I'd had enough of it. And so I said, okay, Jeremy, I'm not going to say Brother Maynard skip a bit. I'm going to let you go for a little bit. So he's up there. He's got the book. And he says, and the people feasted on the goats and the lambs and the pomegranate seeds and the orange blossoms and the ho-hos and the man-witches. When he said man witches, I lost it. So I immediately dropped my head and I started laughing. My whole body shaking. So, and then Matt Lamb's next to me as Sir whatever he was, Galahad, and he starts laughing. His shoulders are shaking. So we're all holding our swords and we're shaking, laughing. So then Jeremy sees this out of the corner of his eye and he starts laughing. So he brings the book straight up in front of his face and his whole body is shaking. Michael Thrash is Patsy holding up the Holy Hand Grenade. He starts shaking. The box is shaking so hard the lid closes. And the audience went wild. They loved. Uh-huh. And so I brought that up to Tom. As I said, Tom, this was a moment where this was appropriate. And it furthered the experience
yes,
for the audience.
Yes,
so,
yes.
And he agreed.
Yeah. There are times. Most thrilling moment on stage.
Most thrilling moment. I would have to say that it was every night of Barnum. Arguably the worst show I've ever been involved with. And it's just it's a bad show. But I got to do circus tricks every night. And I got to juggle fire and flames and fly in on ropes and do all that kind of cool stuff. And again, that was Dirk Lombard. He made sure that we all got that experience. And at the end, Dirk and I were doing, we were juggling clubs, passing them on stage, you know, with all this other stuff going on around us. And that was just thrilling. It's the most fun I've ever had in a show. And it was every night.
Well, Ken.
But a horrible show.
Well,
but you were really good at it.
Well, thank you.
Now, this is really a tack on, but I am quite a bear about this. How important is it to be relaxed on stage?
Oh my God. And that's my kryptonite. You know, if people are say, what's your worst tick? My worst tick is that I'm too stiff on stage. And I'm getting better at it as time goes on. But that's why the first major role that Bo cast me in was the Tin Man. And I jokingly said, oh, you're going to cast Mr. Stiffy as the Tin Man. And she looked right back at me and said, yes. Oh, my God, it's so important. Okay, so one of my favorite actor advice that I ever got, and I had to beg this guy for it. Joe Ford, he was our Scarecrow in Wizard of Oz. He was also Henry Ford in Ragtime. I said, Joe, I said, you have this lithe naturalness on stage that I'm jealous of. And I said, do you have a secret? And he goes, oh yeah, and it's a simple one. He says, noodle arms. I said, what? He goes, pretend your arms are spaghetti noodles, cooked spaghetti noodles. And walk around stage like that. And he goes, no, sometimes it can go too far. He says, but if you keep that in your mind, you will never be stiff on stage.
My gosh.
And I'll be darned if it works. Oh, I've totally done it. I do it in every show.
Sure.
I'll be doing something and I'll think, oh, spaghetti arms.
While on stage.
While on stage.
The play is going on.
Yeah.
But you just have that image.
Usually it's in the working up to it part. You know, like I'll be doing a scene with someone and I'll say, I don't like this. What's wrong with this? I don't know why this isn't working. Oh, I'm too stiff. Okay, spaghetti arms.
Oh, I see. So, yeah, Bob tells the story of being in the green room with Jack Lemmon,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "Do you have any tricks for just before you go on stage?" And he said, "Yes, I do. I always say to myself, well, it's magic time."
Yeah.
And so I think everybody has their little thing they can go. Ken, this has been the most wonderful hour, I have to say. And I have this gift for you.
Wow.
And tell our listening audience what it is.
This is Hollywood Musicals, the 101 Greatest Song and Dance Movies of All Time by Ken Bloom. That's wonderful.
Now tell me you don't have it.
I do not have it. This is beautiful.
And I must say that it took a lot of generosity for me to give it up.
I really appreciate it. That's wonderful.
So, Ken, thank you so much for being here tonight. It has been just marvelous.
Well, thank you.
And this will be as our podcast come next week will be our last podcast. And I'm so glad that we got this in. And so, this is Lynn Pryor asking James to dim the lights and go to black. Well, I urge you all to find a play to see this week. So until next Thursday, thank you for your company. Now, having ended our show, I always add this little PS, this little pod script, Ken,
okay,
to ask my guests if they could possibly know the answer to this question. What is the universal question?
I have no earthly idea.
Well, I'm not surprised. Nobody seems to know the answer. I do. And since I do occasionally drive my car on Yadkin Boulevard, and we know what happens on Yadkin in this town, and so I have the answer in my safe deposit box in case I were not here to give the answer, because it is going to save the world.
Okay.
And so next week, at this very time, at the end of my time with the wonderful Anthony Morrison, I'm going to reveal the answer, and it is going to change the world.
I can't wait.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
For I'm longing for dear old Broadway, longing for dear old town, 'cause I'm longing to stroll on Broadway, watching the world go round, to be back where the boys all